This episode is brought to you by our incredible community of listener supporters on Patreon. Our Patreon offers listeners exclusive archival content, extended episodes, and access to community conversations diving deeper with past guests. Your monthly pledge ensures that For the Wild has the funding to keep producing informative, thoughtful, and rooted conversations and programming. All funding supports our small team of creatives, podcast production, and special For the Wild projects like our zines and slow study courses. To support us on Patreon, please visit patreon.com/forthewild. Or if you would rather make a one-time donation or recurring donation outside of Patreon, please visit forthewild.world/donate. Hello and welcome to For the Wild podcast. I'm Ayana Young. Today we're speaking with Ross Reed.
How do we, as the masses, kind of unite in our beliefs and our values of wanting to have a safe world for our children, of having jobs, of having healthy landscapes, that we don't have to worry about drought every summer and wildfires? Because all of these are symptoms of, yes, climate change, but also poor management of our landscapes. It's like, how can we all unite in a way where we can influence change to the top 1% who really don't want things to change because they benefit immensely from having things the way that they are? That's where it all starts, you know? Understanding and communicating.
Based in the Cascadian bioregion, Ross runs a passion project called Nerdy About Nature, in which he shares fast-paced, fun, informative videos about nature and the world around us as a means for breaking down barriers to access factual, science-based education, while providing critical insight and constructive conversations on environmental and social issues to encourage positive changes in this world to create a more diverse, inclusive, equitable, and just future for us all. Oh, Ross, I'm so happy to be sitting here with you on this very chilly, is it still February morning? The wood stove crackling, and I feel very in the forest with you. And I'm really looking forward to speaking with a fellow forest. Maybe I could say lover, but I don't know yet. So we'll explore that.
A dendrophile, if you will.
Oh, yes. Thank you. That's it.
It's great being here. It was really awesome just having we had like 30 seconds of silence to start this, and I could just hear the wood fire crackling. Felt so cozy. Brought me right into it. Love it.
It is. It was a very brisk morning here. Every morning that it's sunny and clear, which is so beautiful, I know that the cold is coming with that.
Right. And you're up north. Is that Tlingit territory?
Mm-hmm. Tlingit Nation? Yeah. Tlingit territory. Yeah, we haven't been getting as much snow as usual, but I guess that's the way of the world now. Every time it snows, I feel so grateful. I'm just kind of counting my blessings to be with snow and ice.
Oh, man, I know. It's a crazy thing. I'm currently down here on Squamish Nation territory, just outside of Vancouver, BC. And God, I went up trying to go snowboarding yesterday, and the snow was really thin, and I made a post about it. And it's crazy how so many people can be so aware of the lack of snow and the changing seasons, like not the changing of the seasons, but the change within the seasons. It's kind of like long-term thing that we're all actively witnessing and being a part of. And still, there are trolls, there are people that follow me. I got hit up with so much misinformation of people just saying, oh, this isn't the first bad winter we've had. Climate change isn't real. You're overreacting and using scare tactic. And it's just like, sometimes it's so, I don't know, debilitating. Like when you're just constantly hearing that from the internet, you're like, oh, come on. Can't we all just get on the same page with this? Like, it's exhausting at times.
It is exhausting. And I think even when we do get on the same page, then the question is, how do we deal with it? And then that creates a whole other book of pages that get really complicated. I'm glad that you brought up the post, because I really appreciate your platform. And I'd love to think through navigating the nuances that come with having an online platform, but also wanting people to take the time to get off their screens and go outside. Mm-hmm. So how do you balance that?
God, I mean, you know, the inception of like social media, like at its like most basic format, I think like the idea behind it was to get people talking and communicating with one another, right? Like that's how it all started, like, I don't know, over a decade ago, 15 years. I don't know when you would call the birth of social media, but over the past 5 and 10 years, like 5 years, especially like since the kind of Trump era, like it's become this thing that has been so divisive across all lines, like not just like simple political lines, but like lifestyle and thoughts on this and that and religion and all sorts of like, it's like any way you can make a divide, social media seems to be doing that. So I really try to use my platform, Nerdy About Nature, to kind of try to not necessarily break the divide, but try to get people from across different lines talking, and doing that through like an educational platform that focuses on environmental, social, climate issues, like things that teaches people about general ecology and biology of the world that we all share, and hopefully like unites people across these differing perspectives and gets people talking so that we can work together, ideally like using social media as a social platform, and then using that as a way to like educate people so that when they are out in the world experiencing it, they can form better, stronger relationships to it and a stronger connection to it, so that we can like, I don't know, kind of get back to that understanding of our place as fellow animals in this world that we all share, our place amongst everything, you know, as a part of nature, as opposed to apart from nature. So that's kind of like really the goal that I'm trying to do. And I guess social media is the medium. And sometimes I question its efficacy and whether it's worth it for my mental health, because it definitely takes a toll at times when you deal with people on the daily basis who say that things like climate change isn't real. And there's a host of things that people kind of continue to reach for as part of that kind of divisive culture, but just try to hold fast, hold steady, and keep trying to educate people regardless of where they come from, if that makes any sense.
It really does. And I'd really like to hear more about the toll it takes on your mental health, if you're willing to share, because I think that that is a really relatable issue that many people face. And while folks are looking for connection, they often find that debilitating pain of disconnection within the platform. And in an interview with Outside Magazine, you say, quote, "Righteousness can be reductionist. When we are only conveying some ethical or moral judgment, like that everybody who works for oil and gas is evil, or anyone who has ever cut down a tree is wrong, you lose the human element. It's so important to hold on to a sense of humanity. Otherwise, we're doing a disservice to these ideas and movements because we aren't taking aim at the true root of the problem, which is the systems in which we live, like capitalism, which promotes extraction and exploitation of the land and communities to maximize profit," end quote. So yeah, if you could just explore with us the toll on mental health, and really, how can we find space for nuance in a world that really highlights polarization and even dehumanization?
You know, so often I get messages from people like asking me how I stay positive and optimistic in this world, given all that I do, because I really like from a forward facing, like everyone in some sense on social media wears some type of mask, quote unquote, you know, like you're portraying something, and people are like, "Oh yeah, you're always so optimistic and positive. Like, how do you do it?" And I'm like, the reality is that I am human just like all of us. And like, these are very difficult times to be living amongst. Like, everything is in question, you know, not only like our attachments to what we thought life and society would be, you know, what we're all told growing up, you know, you get a job and the government helps and you do all this stuff. And then, you know, you retire, everything, like our whole structure of what we thought life meant was supposed to be is kind of thrown up into this ambiguous questioning right now, because our future is so uncertain in so many ways, if you're paying attention to the science. Now, the issue with that is that the people who are paying attention to the science like see this, and then they try to tell people about it because it is a big deal. But then that gets labeled as like alarmism, or it's so easy for anybody who works in an industry, kind of those at the top of the industry, people who kind of run the capitalist systems we live in, use that as a way to continue to divide people and spread misinformation to keep people from even agreeing on the basic science, which is going to only prolong action, that's only going to keep us in this situation for longer and kind of further their income. It's horribly depressing at times. So I don't know, when you look at the big picture of it all, I try to do the best that I can on like a personal level to like stay grounded and rooted with my surroundings, the people around me, my dog, you know, get out on the land. It's so easy to get sucked into that world of division and feed into that system that is just kind of keeps us from talking together and working with one another as a means of actually creating any positive change. Try to get out on the land and remember like what it's all worth, you know? Thinking about that quote that you read, yeah, so many of the issues we face are boiled down with different sects of society, at least in like the media and how things tend to be painted in an issue like logging, per se, this age-old issue since the war in the woods here in Canada. And then down in the States was the timber wars down in Oregon. So kind of like the mid-90s, you know, it was this classic thing where it was like pitched as loggers versus environmentalists, people trying to save the owls versus saving jobs. Anytime you heard about it in the media, that's how it was pitched. It was pitched as this like grassroots people against people in a community, when the reality is, at the end of the day, we all want the same thing. Whether you're a logger or environmentalist or however you want to identify yourself or somebody else, we all want to be living healthy, happy lives. We all want to have space to explore and be part of the outdoors, be connected to nature. We want to bring our kids there. We want our kids to lead happy, healthy lives. We all want the same things, yet we're stuck in these arbitrary arguments with one another over issues that are really up to the people at the top to like create true solutions. We as citizens in a quote unquote democracy, whether or not you believe it's actually a functional democracy is a whole other subject, but we theoretically should have the ability to be like, hey, this system isn't working. You, the government, we need you to look out for the people here because we are all suffering collectively, whether it's job loss in the logging industry or whether it's habitat loss and environmental degradation on the environmental landscape of things. We're all suffering because of the way this industry is operating. But instead of creating that change, the people who run the industry, who are also tied in with the lobbyists that create policy, everybody up top kind of keeps the people down below bickering and fighting with one another and preventing any real change from actually happening, because it's just so easy to galvanize people and keep the masses fighting with one another instead of directing the energy up top. And so that is a horribly daunting thing, especially in this age of social media and technology. Like everything is just so easily manipulated and thrown into the fire. Like you can just take one thing somebody says, make a meme of it, twist it and turn it. And then like you'll have people who are just, who will, if you they subscribe to an idea, they will stick with that till the very end instead of listening to reason and fact and science. You know, the same science that gives them the phones that they argue on, they will use to the ends to argue that, you know, that climate change isn't real, that different forestry practices aren't better for the ecosystems while also creating jobs. If you're just stuck in that mindset of thinking you only know what you know and unable to learn and adapt and see the world through new eyes, it's endlessly destructive. I don't know. I'm kind of getting overwhelmed even thinking about it.
It's all good. It's impossible to answer, you know, the most challenging questions of our time succinctly. I think it's stream of consciousness works. We're thinking and guessing and hoping while we try to find a way out of the madness.
To that point, with the way that social media has kind of trained all of us, even myself included, and like, oh, like I feel guilty for not being able to answer you succinctly here as my mind rambles down these endless wormholes of despair about the reality of the world we live in. You know, we're all trained to want to have just like a quick 30-second amazing soundbite that like is good and it packs a punch and it goes viral and all that stuff. We all want to condense things into like a short, easy to digest thing. And that's for the most part what I try to do with my videos, but they're like, you know, a minute, minute and a half to 5 minutes sometimes. And I try really hard to break down very complex, nuanced issues in succinct sound bites for people. But the reality is that in order to create any meaningful solutions, we have to have a very deep understanding of these issues. And that requires the ability to have a lot of nuanced, long-winded conversations, hear all the different angles, and be able to take in a lot of things that you can't just easily dumb down to a 30-second soundbite.
It's challenging because we need to meet people where they're at and grab people's attention, and attention span is so short. But then at the same time, these issues aren't black and white, and they need so much discussion and room for patience and room for changing of our understandings of things. Openness, I think, takes time. It takes trust. It's interesting that you bring up the logging debacle. I was so anti-logging for so long because I grew up on the West Coast and I was exploring as a young adult what were these great old growth timber rainforests of California, Oregon, and Washington and BC, and seeing the checkerboard of clear cuts and plantation forests and then slivers of old growth that I would search for, trying to find the last remnants. And when I'd get into the old growth forest, I would feel so at ease and enchanted and mesmerized and intrigued and comforted. And this is it. This is worth living for. This is everything. And so any type of tree cutting, I was so angry about. And I can understand that. I don't blame myself. And then as I've gotten older and I have been working in rural communities for the last decade now, really realizing the nuance. I try to hang out with industry people because I don't want to be somebody who just sits in the ivory tower or sits on a couch and says, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong, when I really don't actually understand what they're thinking or their worldview. And I think it actually makes my, whether you want to call it activism, stronger to understand other people and not just alienate. I was in my little cabin and this tree cutter came over and I was crying about tree cutting. And they were like, well, you know, you heat your house with wood, don't you? Well, yeah. Pointed up at the beams. He's like, these are trees, you know. And of course I knew that. And of course I know I'm implicated. But it was really so clear of, okay, oh, how do I face this? That I live in a structure built of trees and I'm being warmed by trees and I'm cooking on trees. Like the pain and the grief of what that means in this time, because we don't do it sustainably. And so, yeah, how do we even get there? I can tell you work so hard to put these really complex stories into short segments, grab their attention, you keep their attention for the whole time, and hopefully they walk away with an interest to dig deeper. I'm wondering if you see your work meeting people where they're at, but also maybe encouraging people to rethink what they pay attention to.
Yeah, there's this one quote. Forgive me for the length of my letter. I would have been more concise if I had more time. That kind of basically summarizes it. Even me talking right now, I'm like, oh man, I'm being so wordy. I'm talking about so many different things and jumping around, following like wherever my mind's going. Whereas in the videos, I really try to take the time and consolidate and distill a lot of thoughts about multiple different things and try to distill it a nice, easy to capture soundbite for people. Because I know that attention spans are waning. Like people have so little patience for anything that is slow conversation, especially on the medium of social media. When you're actively scrolling through things, like you're not going to stop and listen to like a long-winded, slowly spoken 10-minute video. But if I'm talking really fast, it sucks you in. And it's unfortunate that I've kind of had to go that way. It's unfortunate that that's where society is, but at the same time, it's a great kind of skill and place to be.
If you're trying to encourage people to rethink what they're paying attention to, you know, if you're talking about a big leaf maple, maybe somebody who's walked by a big leaf maple for 100 times never thought about it the way that you're inviting people into something different.
Yeah, I think there's multiple facets of it. And the one that it started with, the major one, is just getting people to be aware of what's around them. So that's like general plant ID, fun facts about things that they see all around them that they maybe hadn't thought about, or certainly hadn't thought about since second or third grade. You know, when you kind of learn about what photosynthesis is at a very basic age, and oh yeah, plants take energy from the sun and, you know, convert to sugars. And then you never think about that in life unless you're going into like the sciences and biology or something like that. Like for everybody else, it's like you learned it once and then you tuned it out. So being able to like reignite that spark of passion for people to think, wow, how incredible it really is that a tree or anything that has photobionts in it, like is able to take energy from the sun to break down water and carbon dioxide to form complex carbohydrates and releasing oxygen. Like that is insane. And so when you can instill like little bits of wonder back in people, it changes the way that people look at the world. So then you're walking around the world and suddenly you notice the things you hadn't noticed before, because you like, oh my God, that's a big leaf maple. And I can't believe that they have, you know, canopy roots way up in their crowns that will punch out into like little pockets of mosses, all those epiphytes that they store on those branches. And they will actually use that to survive during the summer months. That's incredible. You know, it's like if more people knew about all these fun facts, it would change our relationship to the world around us. So that's kind of like the first big pillar there. The second one that's kind of evolved from this project being what it is just trying to engage people in constructive conversation again. I say again, but I actually don't know when that has ever really been happening, but I guess trying to engage people in constructive conversation, because so often on social media and the internet, it's easy to like, if you see something you disagree with, it's anonymous. You can write some hateful comment, hit send and disappear and never have to deal with it. Things that you would never say to people's faces, right? So I really try, and certainly it was easier when the account was smaller. Now it's pretty overwhelming, but I really try to engage with people, whether in the comments or the DM section, like try to, like when they have genuine questions and aren't just trying to like troll or stir the pot, like I will really try to constructively engage and get people talking so that we can reach better understanding and try to have patience where I can to like really walk people through these things. Because the more we're all able to understand and know about the world around us and everything that we share, then that, you know, like I mentioned, it changes our relationship to everything. So really just trying to get people talking and communicating, even when we don't see eye to eye on everything. And I think that's kind of the beauty of it, you know, like we've been so trained, like I said, to kind of be in these silos based on values or religion or whatever it is. And we don't look at anybody else or talk to anybody else, like this kind of like, quote unquote, like new age tribalism, you know, you like, you stick to your group of people and you don't talk to anybody else. But that's not how society works and functions. Like we're not isolated. Like we all shop at the same grocery store. Like we all are part of society. So you have to talk to people. You have to like work with people and engage with people. And I'm trying to get people to do that in a way that is like accepting of the fact that we might not agree on everything. We might not come from the same backgrounds. We might have differing perspectives on things, but we can still work together. We can still like work to figure things out. Your example before about recognizing that you live in a wood home and you burn wood for energy, that's like a great awareness to have. And one of the things that like I have to bring up with people and challenge people to think about is it's like that for wood, and trees are a very easy way to see that our resource extraction, colonial capitalist society takes a thing, turns it into something else, a commodity, and then it becomes part of daily life. But that same thing holds true with anything in your life, whether it be, you know, the metal knobs on your dresser, the glass in a coffee cup, the paint on the walls, like the plastic, you know, like all of the fossil fuels that were fossilized thousands and millions of years ago, all that comes from the earth. And we're using all of these things as resources, and they don't ever go away. You know, we're all still part of this system. You can't just throw it in a dump and like turn a blind eye and it goes away. Like it is always part of us. It's always part of the world. Being able to be aware of where these resources come from, the socioeconomic kind of structures that keep that in place there that have got us to that point, I think is a really good thing to be aware of, because that's where you can use that knowledge to talk with other people of different perspectives and find a new way of going about it. So when we talk about logging, even in everything that I do, like I'm not anti-logging, I'm anti doing it in a way that destroys the ecological function of the world that we live in and biodiversity and community. I'm anti clear-cut logging because there is no way to do that sustainably. If you look at the people who justify clear-cut logging, say like, oh, it replicates natural disturbances like fires and yada yada. And you're like, okay, that might be true in like a very broad, like, you know, bird's eye view. But then you get down to the nitty-gritty, and this is where you get into the nuance, where it's like, okay, clear-cuts, wildfires, if you're trying to say that they're the same, like a clear cut removes all the large woody debris and leaves the fine woody materials on the forest floor here, which sparks more wildfires, whereas a wildfire tends to burn the fine fuels and leave the bigger woody debris, you know, tree trunks and things standing, which become wildlife trees and serve home as the forest kind of regenerates. So it's like on the nuance level, it's like, okay, that's not the same. But even if we're like, well, okay, we'll go along with this this excuse you're using. Those wildfires only happen in certain ecosystems. Fire is a natural part of every forest ecosystem, but it happens on different time scales and small plots of land, like relatively small, because natural forest ecosystems are resilient to wildfires. So it would happen, you know, every 80 to 100 years in the interior of the continent, maybe more frequently, like on like 20 to 40 year time scales. And on the coast, like where I normally live out on Vancouver Island in Nechulnuth territory, those fires, that's a forest ecosystem that has never historically had wildfires at all. So never. In those ecosystems, like, clear cutting is not a natural way for a forest to experience a disturbance. And when you look at the frequency and scale at which that's happened, almost 90% of the forests all across Turtle Island, that's, you know, North America, United States, and Canada, have been leveled to the ground in the method of a clear cut, quote unquote, in just the past 150 years, when historically these wildfires, like any disturbances that look similar to that, would only be 5 to 10% of the landscape at any given time on hundreds of year timescales. So it's like, this is not a natural thing that we're doing. There's no way to justify that. We shouldn't be continuing to do that. So you look at that one little bit, and you're like, okay, clear cutting is bad. But that's not the same as saying end all logging. It's saying, how can we work with the fallers, work with the people who work on the ground here, who are trying to feed their families, who are trying to pay their mortgages, who are trying to like continue to live and exist in society and want to live a life. This is a job. This is an ends to a means. How can we work in a way where we change the economic model so we're no longer having to clear cut in order to get wood? We can do closed canopy, selective harvesting, things that keep the ecological and hydrological function of these forest ecosystems intact while still being able to use it as a resource, because humans are, like I've mentioned, are wild animals. We've always been active parts of these ecosystems, not apart from them. We will always need and have a use for wood, but how can we do it differently where we can maintain jobs and communities, where we don't have, you know, the boom and bust of logging towns that is so familiar in the Cascadian bioregion? You drive anywhere from BC down through Washington, Oregon, and Northern California, there are so many little ghost towns of what used to be booming cultural hubs where logging happened in the 60s and 70s, but, you know, unrestrained clear cutting. And then all of a sudden they're out of it and the economy crashes and people have to move out. People lose their jobs. Those who stay, you know, struggle to survive. Drug addiction becomes a thing. It's like, it's not a sustainable way to be doing business. So the more that we can understand, you know, the nuance of the ecological functions, the nuance of the biodiversity, the nuance of all the kind of sciencey bits that like relate to our relationship with the world, as well as the social economic things that kind of create the system that we live in, we can find ways to talk across differing party lines to unite on kind of these, the reality, you know, the science, be like, okay, we know that this doesn't work. We know that this doesn't work. Let's try something different. Let's work together to find a solution that works for everybody. That's kind of like the meat of like what I'm really trying to get people doing, is like, step one, becoming aware of your surroundings. Step two, talking with people about the way that we use our surroundings so that we can do it better. How do we, as the masses, kind of unite in our beliefs and our values of wanting to have a safe world for our children, to have, of having jobs, of having healthy landscapes, that we don't have to worry about drought every summer and wildfires? Because all of these are symptoms of, yes, climate change, but also poor management of our landscapes. It's like, how can we all unite in a way where we can influence change to the top 1% who really don't want things to change because they benefit immensely from having things the way that they are? And that's where it all starts, you know, understanding and communicating.
Whew, I hear you. It is. It's a real...
That was a long-winded tangent, but I hope I brought that back full circle.
No, it actually like revitalized me. It like touched that part that I'm like, yes, yes, yes. Like we need to always circle back around to how we get out of it, because there will be nothing left if we don't stop now. And we're already, gosh, we're so on the edge. You see the numbers and it's 4% of all old growth redwoods left. You know, it's very, very small percent. It's always under 10% of whales, forests, you know, everything that is so life-giving but heartfelt. Things that they're not things. They're creatures, they're beings, they're our kin, our comrades, our lovers, our family. And we're losing them so quickly to badly designed systems. And it is complicated to restructure the systems, but ultimately, what are we going to do? Like, that is our job. That is what we are here to do, is to learn how to
be a part of it.
I like to believe that we're here because we're trying to be in right relationship, because I know that our mental health is better when we're in right relationship. Our relationships with other humans are stronger. Like, everything, I think, benefits when we are in the flow of reciprocity. And when we get out of that, it's horror. It's terror. I mean, the people on top that are making the billions, they got problems. Just because they have all this money, that doesn't suddenly mean that they're not dealing with drug addiction, depression, relationships falling apart.
They can just afford to not have to pay attention to it, you know? I don't think you're thinking about depression when you're on a yacht. Maybe. I don't know. I've never been on a yacht.
I think there's a lot of unseen consequences of wealth accumulation. I think it actually, maybe the yacht distracts people from their depression, but the depression itself isn't gone. Like, the disconnection from one another, denialism takes a toll. It takes a toll to be so separate from 99% of everybody else. There's distractions on all levels from the pain. And let's just say we're believing that this pain is from disconnection from nature. I'd love to hear your thoughts on what it means to connect with nature in times like these. And, you know, there's the romanticized versions, there's the realities. I mean, there's different realities for everybody. So much of what I've been saying is, oh, they're disconnected from nature, we got to reconnect. Mm-hmm. But those words, it almost kind of feels shallow, or maybe not shallow, but what does that even mean?
That's an interesting concept, because the way that I see it, it's really difficult to do it authentically in a capitalist system. The idea of capitalism kind of originated in, kind of stems from, like, old religious ideas. Whether or not you're Christian or however, whatever religion you believe in, capitalism kind of originated in this idea that the world was created for mankind, for, you know, white people, basically, European white people. And everything was theirs to use, to like use as a resource, to commodify, to live the best life that they could. And then you started putting value on things. And that has just kind of snowballed into colonialism, you know, where you went to foreign lands and you said, oh, these people aren't really people. We can take their land, we can take the resources, we can do all this so we can generate more wealth for us, so we can live our best life to appease God's desires, and that so that we can go on. And that's kind of like the root of capitalism. Like, you know, even if you go for a walk, you know, we're trained to think, like, you know, time is money. How much time did I spend in the woods today? Oh, that's like an hour I could have gotten paid. You know, what's, you know, we talk about natural capital, and like, that's just trying to fit these natural things into a capitalist society. It's like, how do we give a tree a monetary value as a standing thing? You know, how do we look at the natural services it provides, from, like, you know, retaining like the riverbanks to giving us oxygen and filtering water? Like, how do we put capital on that? You know, and it's such a broken way of looking at the world, because no matter how you cut it, it intrinsically separates us from the natural world. And this is like an idea that, like, you see all through the States and through Canada, like the idea of like national parks is kind of like the classic conservation method. This idea of like pristine nature, of pristine wilderness, inherently separates not people from the landscape necessarily, but like Western people, because Western society doesn't view themselves as part of nature. So it's like, oh, we're going to set this aside as a reserve, and nobody's allowed to go in there or touch it, because that's nature, and we're people, and we live outside of nature in our homes that are definitely not part of nature, even though, as you mentioned before, it's all made from wood and natural things. Like, it's all like, we are part of nature. And when you look at it, like, how many indigenous peoples have been forcefully evicted and massacred and removed from those places, from those sites, from Yosemite, you know, so that this could be a park with no quote unquote people, even though people are and always have been active parts of these ecosystems. We are animals. We are all kin in that, like, we all share the same common ancestor of life that was born onto this planet. And then through various, you know, evolutionary processes of selection and natural selection and all sorts of different things, we ended up with fungi or funga, fauna, and flora. You know, we have plants, animals, and fungi, all these different things. Like, but we've all are kin. We're all siblings. We're all come from that same bit of life. It's not like they were just planted by different things. Like, again, like going back to religion, whatever God you believe in, even a lot of like Christian beliefs nowadays kind of center on the evolutionary thing. Like they've accepted this as a scientific thing because science is rooted in the reality of the world we live in. Like there is no way to deny some of these things, these processes. So that separation is something that is kind of like inherently built into the systems that we've got today that have kind of arisen from belief systems. And it's really difficult to break that. I don't know if we actually can within that system, but I do think it is incredibly important to reflect upon those systems as best as you can, as best as one can, and learn to like create your own like connections, your own culture to it. So often today, like speaking as a white cis male from settler descent on Turtle Island here, so many people within our society are displaced from where they came from, whether they were taken here against their will or whether they came here trying to seek a new life. Like we've left kind of our short-term kind of ancestral heritages and cultures. And maybe you bring some element of culture with you from like food to religious practices or whatever, but like none of that comes from the lands that we're on. So I feel like as a broad societal statement, a lot of us are grasping for things. And within that, there is this really easy tokenism of like a lot of indigenous culture that people will run to and grasp onto. They'll get some sage and not think about like the ethical way that that sage was harvested, the spiritual connections to like Navajo or anything like that, and use that to like, oh, sage a room. And this kind of like just grasping for things that feel more authentic than what we know, because we are so displaced as people. Like we don't have that rooting to the culture. But just because you're not from a place, I would argue, doesn't mean that you can't become naturalized to a place. Doesn't mean that you can't learn to create your own connection to those lands. And I think that starts with people getting out on those lands, reflecting on the way that our society and this capitalist system has kind of shaped our mindset around, you know, created all these attachments to how we think things should be, and getting out and just like enjoying the view, not taking your phone, not taking a watch, not taking anything beyond like what you need to exist in those elements, and like being amongst it. And like, if you're hungry, like try to find a berry, like learning how to forage, like learning how to like see the reciprocity and the connection to our fellow kin, and recognize that like we are all here to support each other, regardless of what gender, class, race, species, like all the things that we use to divide, you know, not only our species, but like separate us from everything else. On a broader sense, like we're all a bunch of raving speciesists who think that, you know, humans are above everything else, this anthropocentric kind of lens. And like, we are not above everything else. We are a part of it. So I think that getting out, grounding in whatever way that you can, feet on the dirt, breathing the air, drinking the water, like really finding home in the ground under your feet and the lands on which you live, the water that you drink, like all of that gives you a greater connection to it. And then with that connection comes, you know, stewardship, a responsibility to protect it, and a responsibility to act in ways that see its health being like its health into the future when threatened by things like, you know, the colonial capitalist system we live in, when industry comes in and wants to build a mine or, you know, cut down the forest in your backyard. Like that connection is what's going to motivate you to stand up and do something to protect it, to challenge the system that we live in that is so hell-bent on dividing us and keeping us separate from that.
Kind of stick with the reconnection, disconnection to nature theme, I thought we could dig a little bit into the contradictions of outdoor recreation, industry, culture. In an interview with Outside Magazine, you say, quote, especially coming from an outdoor sports background, a lot of my experiences in the outdoors have been shallow and self-centered, but skiing amongst the trees made me want to understand the environments I was recreating in. I wanted to know the ecology of those places. As I learned more, it gave me a deeper sense of companionship for those spaces because I was no longer just looking at them as expendable things for me to jump off of or ski around. And with greater connection comes responsibility, end quote. So I thought you could respond with maybe sharing a bit of your personal history with outdoor recreation. And then maybe how has the outdoor recreation industry contributed to a more shallow or even extractive relationship to the outdoors?
Yeah, that's a good one. I mean, I've often wrestled with this and had conversations with friends and stuff about whether or not recreation is an extractive resource. In many cases, it definitely fits the bill. I can't say that many industries or many aspects of the industry really give back to the land and those who live amongst them, aside from just the people. Yeah, I mean, I was super fortunate to have grown up skiing at a young age. You know, my dad's side of the family, that's what they did. So when I was like 2 years old, I was on skis, and we owned a family ski cabin with like me and my three cousins' families. And we all just every weekend, we just packed that thing full. It slept like 18 people. So it was like me and all my cousins just every weekend going up there and skiing. And so it was very much like a part of who I was. And it was great. You know, some of my favorite memories come from that time. It was physically active. It was great for mental health. It was the thing where I first kind of really discovered independence. Like I could pick my own line down a mountain. I could do my own thing. And then like the only thing that was resting on whether or not I got down there was myself. You know, it wasn't like a team sport necessarily where there was like all the pressure on you. I feel like it's a really good place for people to find and know themselves. Skiing, biking, hiking, any sort of like outdoor thing. It's like when you're out there with just you, like relying just on yourself to like do a certain thing, it's really empowering in a way. And there's a lot of things in society that don't give you that same aspect of that sort of empowerment. So it's really great like that. But at the same time, there's no denying the hypocrisy. Skis are not environmentally cheap to produce, nor is the outerwear, the goggles, any of the stuff that you wear, especially like in the 90s when I was like growing up. No one had wool. It was all synthetic, you know? And like now it's better because there are a lot of really good wool companies out there that are getting back to natural fibers. But skis and outerwear is still horribly environmentally expensive to create. Not only that, but then like the access element, you know, a majority of people do their riding from lift access stuff. And then the goal, you know, the glorified thing in the industry is to be able to afford to go on a heli ski trip somewhere or cat skiing or something, or fly around the world to go visit all these amazing places. And like, I have done a bit of that, you know, like I've been to Japan a few times, love Japan, like the culture, the snow, everything's incredible. I've partaken in that system. But I think like for a lot of people, that's where it stops, you know, like that's kind of like the end goal is this like consumption based thing where like, I'm going to ski around the world and I'm going to ski the best, pal. I'm going to make it. I'm going to like, it's like a very kind of greedy thing. Like, oh, I scored those conditions. The surf was firing that day. It was just me out, you know, and everybody's kind of like racing to do this thing in a very highly competitive way, but not in your kind of standard, you know, football, like Broncos versus the Chiefs. I don't know. I don't know. Football, that was a terrible analogy, but you know what I mean? Like, it's not like that same kind of competition dynamic. Yet the hypocrisy of like using all these fossil fuels and resources to do this for a very selfish pursuit is often overlooked. So for me, like, you know, I grew up not only going skiing, but like, you know, I was out playing in the mud and like lived close to a forest. And in the 90s, that was still when you could like go outside and play in the mud and in the forest behind school during recess. I don't think they let kids do that anymore. So like, I kind of already had like a connection to nature and the woods and things, and then going out and kind of having a background in biology and continuing to read about things and ecology and understand things, like it gave me a really amazing lens to kind of go to those places through and see, like, you know, the evolving ecology of mountainous regions. And like, that's awesome. That was like part of like what birthed this whole Nerdy About Nature project for me. I think there's a lot of room for people to continue to do that, because even as is, like, the industry is still a very shallow one. Like, it's amazing because it gets people out onto the lands and gets them forming connections, which, as I've mentioned, is kind of the basis of any sort of stewardship for it. Like, you have to care about something in order to want to protect it, to want to keep it in a good, healthy state. So that's amazing. But the way that we're going about it is still just not that thoughtful. And I think, you know, there's a lot of like band-aid solutions that, you know, big companies are trying to offer, like, you know, heli ski companies will offset their emissions so they're quote unquote carbon neutral. But it's like, dude, you're burning fucking Jet A fuel for hours. Like, there's no way you're carbon neutral. Ski resorts will be powered by, you know, biofuel or wind power or something, which is like, okay, cool, that's a start, sure. But that's still just like looking at the mechanical operations of things. Like, what's the impact on the lands when you have hundreds of thousands of people coming up, spending hundreds of dollars a day? Like, it's ridiculously expensive. So it's like, again, all kind of feeding into that capitalist mindset. I think there's a lot to be rethought with, again, like wilderness areas, quote unquote wilderness, these wild lands, these ways to get onto the land and do things and bring community into it. You have to also remember that all of these sports, well, yeah, most of them, I would say like 99% of them, are still happening and taking place on stolen indigenous lands. And very little of that actually goes back to supporting the indigenous communities who have stewarded those landscapes since time immemorial, you know, for literally thousands and thousands of years. So I think there's like a lot of opportunity moving forward, like rethinking things. And one of the things that I'm really strongly advocating for is indigenous run and led tourism operations and tribal park areas where it's managed by the local nations and the proceeds to that go to supporting that nation to give them, you know, a means of surviving in a post-colonial still a colonial world, like a world that is not inherently rigged for them to succeed, you know, like these communities. So doing that in a way that helps support communities so they can continue to grow and thrive and steward these lands in a way that doesn't involve them, you know, extracting the resources in a more material way in the form of logging or mining, and doing it in a way that supports culture. So recreation isn't an extractive resource on like the invisible stuff, you know, like sucking the soul and the life out of an area by loving it to death. You know, like, we need to be able to show restraint and use foot powered traffic, you know, biking up places. Like, I think it would be amazing to have a ski area where there's like logging roads and you could like bike to the trail entrance and then like ski tour up and then ski down. And it's like, yeah, it's like a longer process. It's a lot more work, but like, you're forming a much more genuine and authentic connection to the land instead of just using it as a resource, as like looking for like pillow lines and down trees to ride and all sorts of different features. Like, obviously you're still looking for that because that's like where the fun of it is. It's not just in that take, take, take mentality. And it's like, you have to like work for it and earn your turns. I think there's a lot that we can learn going back to like the reciprocity of things and learning how to connect to these lands and better steward them. And I think that the more you understand about, as I mentioned previously, our social economic systems and the ecology of an area, you realize that there's no way that capitalism really works better these environments, these ecosystems. You know, we have to find a new way of thinking about the way that we interact with it and like use it for social, personal, mental health, all sorts of different values beyond the myopic resource extraction model.
Oh, just kind of sitting in the complexity with you and feeling into the many pieces and my origin story of how I found out about you, which was during the Ferry Creek blockade. And so maybe we could end on taking some time to hear about your involvement with that movement and how you see land defense as central to your work. Maybe any updates on the Ferry Creek front?
So yeah, for those who are unfamiliar, Ferry Creek blockades is now to date the single largest act of civil disobedience in all of Canadian history. And this is a really interesting, it's an interesting thing just as a tangent before we get into all this. Like, I love how COVID was the taste of socialism that we needed to really kind of like get some change going, you know, like without COVID. Like, I know it was horrible and miserable for a lot of people and lockdown was awful, but like that was the first time people were kind of broken free of their daily 9-to-5 grind and can actually think about things and be like, hey, you know, you shouldn't treat people like George Floyd like this. Like, let's have a Black Lives Matter kind of uprising, you know, like that would have never happened if it wasn't for COVID. Same with the Ferry Creek blockades. Like, there's a lot of things that I think society was finally able to breathe from, like, just existing in this rigmarole, this rat race of capitalism that we've created, and be like, okay, hold on. What are we doing? This doesn't make sense. Let's put our foot down and stand up against it. So like, that's amazing. I think that's just like a little asterisk of like, yeah, see, socialism can be a good thing. Like, look at the way the French deal with things. It's like when things go wrong, like they riot, they use their voice because they can't afford to. They're not like living necessarily paycheck to paycheck. They have social support systems that ensure they're going to be able to survive even if they miss a day at work. So Ferry Creek was this thing happened during the pandemic where, you know, of all the watersheds on Vancouver Island, a majority of them have been logged, again, clear cut logged. And on the southern part of Vancouver Island, there's one watershed known as Ferry Creek. And it's in Pachacut territory, just outside of Port Renfrew on the southern tip of Vancouver Island. And it was slated to be logged by a private company known as Teal Jones. And at the same time, this report had been put out by Drs. Rachel Holt, Karen Price, and Dave Dost, who, again, wouldn't have had the time to put the report out if it hadn't been for COVID. They credit the COVID lockdown as the thing that gave them the time to put the report out. And that is basically the thing that triggered this whole movement, because in that report, they detailed the lack of old growth forests remaining in the province. And I could go into the weeds here on the numbers with you, but basically it's like 2.7% of the most highest productivity forest that ever exists in the province is remaining. There's a lot of nuances with old growth definitions, you know, high productivity versus low productivity. Again, I could go into the weeds with this, but I'm just going to keep this very overview. Basically, the government likes to say there's a lot of old growth left, when in reality, you know, they say about 20% of forest is old growth, but in reality, a majority of that is low productivity old growth that hasn't been logged, isn't threatened to be logged because it's in areas like high alpine environments or boggy marshes. And all of the really good, big, massive old growth forest, the thing that you think about when you picture an old growth forest, you know, those all lie in valley bottoms, riverbeds, like very easy access places where a lot of development has happened, you know, like the townships of Vancouver and Victoria, like those were initially logging towns and ports where logging occurred. And then, you know, they continued to build outward. All that old growth, like it's a very slim percentage left. Very little is standing, and even less of it is protected. So this whole movement got people out into the woods at Ferry Creek, protesting, blockading, stopping logging from happening. And then it exposed a really horrible dark side of the colonial system we live in, with the RCMP just violently abusing land defenders in the most horrific of ways, covering badges, no accountability, covering their faces, literally beating people, pepper spraying people. Horrible, horrible, horrible videos started coming out of the woods about all of this, because this is in an area where there wasn't cell service. So everything, there was like a delay on it. And the things that were coming out of there was just, it was awful. It was like incredibly depressing to know that there was like that little old growth left. And then to also know that the industrial arm that was trying to log and is still trying and is still logging the last of that old growth is so heavily supported by the colonial government that exists in this province, in this country, on this entire continent. And like, that's a really difficult thing to grasp. I didn't go to the blockades because I know myself and I know I have a big mouth and I can run it really well. And so I just was like, if I go, then I'm going to get arrested. So I abstained from going because I was going through some legal stuff and I just couldn't have risked it. But I had just started this amazing little account called Nerdy About Nature. And I was talking about trees and all sorts of stuff and old growth that had been something dear to me. So it became like the perfect medium to actually use that platform to educate people on all of the nuances of the numbers that I've mentioned previously and the situation and like offering solutions, you know? And so that's kind of been an ongoing thing where I've like, you know, was really active in getting people engaged in these conversations and activating them on a policy level to like sign waivers and petitions and go rally and, you know, use their voice in, again, a so-called democracy. Theoretically, we should be able to use our voices to stand up for the things we believe in. And I'm still kind of on that plight. I'm still offering solutions and still doing solutions videos, but this is twofold tangent here. Social media only rewards divisiveness. If I post a video that is like ranting about something that's like wrong with the world, it sees millions of views. If I post a video that is solutions based, that is like, hey, here is a viable solution where we can maintain jobs and economy and build communities, strengthen our ecosystems, do all this stuff, it sees maybe a couple hundred views. It's ridiculous how the algorithm favors content that drives conflict. And so that's really annoying and depressing to still kind of like exist with today, and to still trying to find ways to challenge the algorithm so I can make something that like gets people thinking in a positive, constructive manner and get seen, but without being too positive and optimistic that nobody sees it at all because the algorithm doesn't favor that. And then also now to be, what is it, 2024? So yeah, 4 years down the line since Fairy Creek began, and to see the lack of integrity in the government doing what they said they were going to do. Broad overview of it is that they've basically started a lot of really slow working processes that makes it look like they're doing a lot to actively protect things. And they are doing things in the realm of like supporting indigenous nations and taking control of their land back, their land and resources, and working with those who have chosen to defer logging on their territories to create sustainable ways to protect those forests into the future. It's amazing, but it's like still just like a sliver. Like, for example, in October, they announced, the province of British Columbia announced that they would give $300 million to sustaining these nations who chose to defer logging on their territory for the next, I think it's a 10-year thing. So $300 million for 10 years. Meanwhile, the province still subsidizes the clear, like companies, private and public companies that do clear-cut logging on these lands, $365 million every year. So it's like, yes, it's great that you're supporting indigenous like land back and sovereignty and giving them access again to the resources that you stole from them 150 years ago, but you're still also still like allowing the system to continue as it is. And meanwhile, everything that's like not outside of Fairy Creek, like Fairy Creek kind of stole the limelight, like everything North Island has just been obliterated. You know, anywhere where the industry saw could be threatened, where their logging tenures could be threatened in the next couple of years, they just went full steam ahead. And they're not even like, they just like are clearing the land, like cutting everything and leaving it on the ground and going to take it out later, because they know as long as they cut it and it's on the ground, they can still have access to it later. So it's like just created a rush of more old growth logging. You know, old growth logging actually went up in 2021 versus down like the government had said it was. And so it's created all these other things. They've quelled the protests and they've quelled the uprising by saying that they're doing stuff. And the stuff they're doing, it has its merits, but it's happening so slowly when the real thing that needs to happen is just like a hard stop on the industry so we can reassess what the heck is going on. So we can like take a look and take stock of things. Every time you hear an update on how much old growth is remaining, the real number is less than that because they've logged it since they've done that. Many of the deferrals that they deferred, a majority of those were logged. So it's just, I don't know. This is where me, again, as like a human experiencing human emotions, struggles to be optimistic sometimes. I appreciate you for sharing that bit of empathy towards the 1% earlier. And like, that's amazing. Like, I'm trying to channel that now. Like, how can I be empathetic to people in this system? But it's like, the system is still largely failing the people. And how do you, like, short of a revolution, like how do you change that in a system that is like designed and supposed to be one that suits the needs of the people, where we're supposed to have equal voices for every individual? They still only listen to the voices of the corporations. And like, that's like a horribly depressing reality to come to terms with. And I'm still wrapping my head around it, still trying my best to be a part of these conversations and push for change. And I still hold strong in thinking that the best way to do that is through education and through empowering people through knowledge so that they can have more nuanced, well-rounded, understanding conversations with people so that we can reach solutions. But at some point, those solutions aren't ever going to happen if the system doesn't allow them to. And that's kind of where we're at right now.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that the rage and the anger towards the 1% is valid and in ways beautiful, because it's acknowledging the destruction that they are leading I think for me, the empathy comes in with trying to psychologically and spiritually understand what is really going on here. And I'm interested in like understanding these humans that are just humans that are holding so much power. And I feel like if I can get into that space, just like getting into the space of the logger or the tree cutter or whoever, it's like, what's really going on here? I would say the rage that you're speaking to or the anger or the frustration is, to me, is it's a real respectful acknowledging and witnessing of what's really happening.
Just one more note on that. Like, I think it's important to recognize that, like, the issues and the rage, like, it's not necessarily towards the individual people. It's towards the system and the way the system is built. I think for the most part, a lot of people in society, and especially those who are kind of in these positions of power, are more or less checked out. Like, I don't think that they're conscious of their power or the way that they're holding it. And I don't necessarily think that they're doing it in a consciously selfish way. I think it's their complacency within the system that allows it to continue doing the things that it's doing is what's really frustrating, because it's like, ideally you vote politicians into a system to create change, but then they run into the same hurdles that we are experiencing, where it's like, you can't create change in a system that doesn't actually want to change. So it's not the people, it's like the system. Like, how do you change the system through people? I don't know.
To be continued, probably for forever and ever and ever,
right.
These questions. So gosh, thanks so much for sitting in the complexity with me and mulling it all over. I hope we can connect again in the future.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you so much for having me on. For the Wild is one of my absolute favorite podcasts. So I'm just absolutely honored to be able to speak with you here. Truly been a pleasure.
Thanks, Ross.
Thank you for listening to this episode of For the Wild. The music featured in this episode is by Greenhouse, courtesy of Leaving Records. For the Wild is created by Ayana Young, Erica Ekram, Julia Jackson, and Jackson Kroof.